conclude our testimony. I'm Barry Cast, Administrator of Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. Today we'll hopefully conclude our testimony during the hearing phase of the division's budget. But we wanted to begin, before going back into the presentation document, with any issues or concerns raised during what I thought was a remarkable visit yesterday. I think you should know as chair that we haven't had that kind of legislative interest and representation on a visit to the hospital.
Really?
In quite some time, yes. And I very much appreciate the interest of the legislature in the condition of the hospital and its programs. So, as per your agenda for today, Dr. Mazurhart has joined us for any discussion that you would like to pursue. And when that portion is wrapped up, we have a presentation on administration, capital issues, and then for the most part, I think we're done until our work session.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This probably would fit better into the discussion of capital projects, but one of the issues that was raised yesterday was the Americans with Disabilities Act, short-range and long-range plan, and I'd be interested to see how those ADA changes that you need to make, upgrades, fit within your capital request in this budget and what things didn't make it on the chart because you had to reprioritize and take reductions and so forth. So that's one of my follow-up questions.
Yes.
Stan.
Okay. My name is Stan Mazurhart, and I'm the superintendent at Oregon State Hospital, and Madam Chair, Representative Carlson. We do have an ADA implementation plan that we can provide you. And in the larger scheme of capital improvement, deferred maintenance request, well, it's a capital improvements request, we do have those, but they are prioritized within, along with all the other needs that we have.
So, Madam Chair, follow up.
So
as you go through the capital discussion, could you just highlight for me, as you go through it, which pieces are ADA related? I mean, that would be really helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, we can do that.
All right, thank you.
Do you have any questions from yesterday?
First, Madam Chair, I thought it was. I started out thinking, I want to do this yesterday for lots of reasons. One of which was, could I get back to the Capitol? But you were very. It was a very good tour yesterday, and you answered my questions as we went on the tour, and I appreciate that from your physician, and I appreciate the questions and the answers you gave me. My only concern on that tour was that I'm still concerned about overcrowding and whether or not the facility can be maintained in a way that will allow us to expand the future. Obviously, the population we're dealing with is going to expand. I don't see any reason it's going to get smaller, and so there's questions there that have to be answered, and you're working on those, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I think for myself, the overcrowding issue is a concern because not only when you see the stacking up, but it also creates, and I may be mistaken, but I would think that it would create some pressures on staff protection and some of the other issues. And as you know, Barry, you and I talked earlier, one of my concerns is the protection of our staff as well as providing a facility that is conducive for the patients that you serve. So certainly looking at some of those occupied rooms that have 5 and 7 individuals in them, I would think would tend to lend itself to some aggression that could be tempered if you weren't stacked in a small space. I think there was a study once that was done by Stanford or Harvard that talked about when you put rats in a very close quarters and you begin adding more and more, they begin to really become a lot more aggressive and turn on each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always mindful of that study when I think about how we stack human beings and our reaction as humans when we don't have space.
Mm-hmm.
So. Madam Chair, the crowding is a critical issue for us, as is safety of both patients and staff, and in this budget, there is a recognition that the census at the hospital has grown, but we don't manage the hospital the way a private setting would, that is, opening and closing wards according to how many patients in the hospital. The governor's budget does request an additional ward on July 1st. That would go a long way toward relieving existing crowding, but we already have the number of patients in the hospital that would be transferred to that ward, and a second ward for the second half of the biennium. The entire growth is coming from the forensic area, for the most part from people who are waiting for trial because they are not fit to proceed or in the process of being treated until fit to proceed. That is a growing population, and I can tell you that I receive calls from law enforcement, from sheriffs around the state, about inmates that they are ready to transfer to the state hospital, but we have slowed that process down some, and that causes problems for local corrections entities. So I think you've identified what is in this budget, at least for us, the key issue with respect to safety and crowding and quality of care.
You indicated that the problem exists because of primarily the trial waits that are taking place. What's occurring in the courts that we're getting a lot more individuals than what we've had in the past? Are we getting a lot more?
Madam Chair, you know, it's speculative at this point, but there are probably any number of reasons. One that we see in terms of the numbers of folks we get and the length of stay with folks under ORS 161370 is that the folks who come to us are just simply more ill than folks we've seen in the past. And that takes a longer period of time for them to reconstitute sufficiently to return to courts. It's the length of stay as much as the admissions that really add to that overcrowding problem. Whether Measure 11 has had an impact on this, we don't know. There's been some speculation around that. How folks are seen by the sheriff and the jail personnel once they are put in jail and charged with a crime, the behaviors that they see, whether they're more sensitive to those behaviors that may indicate a mental illness. And, of course, there's the complicating factor that we haven't talked a lot about, but around the major mental illnesses that we see, the interspersing, the use, the dual diagnosis of significant drug abuse. And that really complicates the picture in terms of what's going on with these folks at the time they committed the crime and then as they're getting ready for trial.
That's the key.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of those would you think are dual diagnosed?
Madam Chair, in terms of our population, it's generally at least half of the folks that we see in that system have some involvement at a significant level, particularly younger males with drug abuse, substance abuse in general, and that's higher when you count alcohol as well, of course.
Well, are we ready to move on then?
Yeah, we can, I think, unless the one else has additional questions.
Well, let me, for the record, Madam Chair, thank the Stan and the staff at the State Hospital for making the hospital available, and I thought they did a good job. I hope you share that view. A lot of people express the view, some anxiety about going to the state hospital. They anticipate bedlam and chaos. And in fact, we know how to treat very ill people, and I think my hope is that you have the impression that I do, which is we have a very well-run program inside of what is somewhat antiquated physical plant, and we hope in the future to find a way to improve the physical plant and preserve the quality of the program.
I just wonder how you don't get lost going through the tunnel.
Madam Chair, I do get lost going through the tunnel. If we're ready to move on,
yeah.
We have two sections remaining in the presentation document. The first is administration. This relates to the overall management of the division and its programs and the financing of community administration for the large amounts of funds that we do transmit to the counties and for which they are responsible for management. And to assist us with that, Margaret Johnson, Deputy Administrator of the Division, has prepared a brief presentation.
Good morning. My name is Margaret Johnson. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. And I will begin in your book behind the tab called Administration on page 4C1. The main functions that are performed in our administrative structure are contained within the Office of the Administrator, which, you know, our office is mainly responsible for the general oversight of the division, including the hospitals and the training centers, as well as the community programs. We also provide, we have a unit which provides abuse investigations and training for both our state-operated programs and community-operated programs. We also have a relationship with the Department of Corrections, whereby we have a staff who is involved in reviewing the mental health programs that are provided for inmates within the individual correctional facilities across the state. That person goes on a regular basis, visits the programs, and provides feedback to them on the quality of their operations and provides a certification role to those facilities and works closely with the management of the Department of Corrections. In our Office of Finance, we basically are basically contained several of the business kind of support services. We have a federal resource component that helps us assist in monitoring basically Medicaid programs and requirements. We have a budget section, an audit section, and then a couple of folks who deal with our intergovernmental agreements with the counties. And those are the main vehicle that we use to contract the bulk of our business out to local service providers. We also collect revenue from patients in our state-operated facilities and establish a billing cost of care and then collect where there are resources available.
How much do you collect in that particular category?
Madam Chair, there are a variety of sources that we collect from. Medicaid is the major payer for the facilities that are for the folks who are eligible for Medicaid. In the state hospital, those are people who are under 21 and over 65. I don't know the exact amounts. We also collect a significant amount of resources from Medicare, private insurance, and then to the extent that patients are able to contribute to the cost of their care, there is a collection amount from them that's calculated on their ability to pay. And it's a fairly small amount of the total cost of the operation of the facilities.
You have self-pay, Medicare, Medicaid.
Mm-hmm, and private insurance.
And private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have a dollar amount?
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, in the big budget document, there is a revenue page that breaks down agency-wide for those categories for patient resources and insurance, and it doesn't split it out by institution, but that's about $12.6 million for the agency.
Go ahead. Thank you. Oh, and another question. What is the function and responsibilities of the DD Council?
The DD Council is a federally funded operation that is charged by the federal government to provide advocacy and on behalf of people with developmental disabilities and to provide leadership in development of new program technologies or approaches for the care and rehabilitation of folks with developmental disabilities.
The charge to the council originated in a executive order of the governor in the 1980s, and we can make that available. But the council is entirely federally funded, and the agreement permits the council to be a part of state government and also fulfill its federal obligations under the DD Act.
Excuse me, I'm usually using their outside so that they can be somewhat independent and not be inside of the organization itself. Okay.
Madam Chair, I think the purpose of the executive order was to preserve both their independence and their role within state government. The federal law permits that. In a number of states, the DD councils are independent, and in some states, they remain a part of state structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that model has been considered, for example, for the multicultural health proposal that Senator Gordley has brought forward as a way of providing independent review even within what has traditionally been a state office. And it, frankly, functions very well. I think many of the innovative programs that you've seen, self-directed supports, respite initiatives, and so forth, a family support program, really began with a lot of planning and effort on the part of the council, and we value very greatly their contribution over the years.
Representative Schrader.
I assume all the fund, the six positions are all federally funded in the Developmental Disabilities Council?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, that's correct.
Follow-up?
Actually, not a follow-up, it's a different question.
With regard to question.
Yes, sorry about that. With regard to the administrative division stuff, you have the Office of Investigation and Training talked about the abuse. What if we get a kind of little spreadsheet on over time what the track record has been as far as abuse, complaints, actions taken and resolved within certain times? Some of the other smaller agencies have given us that type of profile to show what their activity level is and how they're doing, how they're accomplishing their tasks.
Then we also have, we manage a small budget centrally that provides for payments to, on behalf of our patients and residents in our state operated facilities in cases where they need, because of a medical condition, they need to go to a general hospital, and we reimburse for those services. We also then provide, in the category described as local administration, funding to the counties on behalf of their, to help offset the cost of their management of the resources that we contract to them. It partially reimburses them for the costs they incur in contracting, in managing the services on behalf of the state that are provided either directly by the county or that are subcontracted by the counties.
Question?
Representative Frederick Williams.
Just want to make clear, this is just going to county governments, or, and in regard to that, if that is true, then is there any duplication of administrative oversight here? Are we looking at these contracts at the state level and then sending them down to the community level and having them reevaluate them again? What is the difference in the oversight between the state and the community level, I guess, would be the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, the state responsibility is to set standards through administrative rule and so forth that pertain to each of the individual programs that we manage. The county, the function that the county performs is a variety of functions, most of which are operational. It's how do you provide the necessary contracting services, the necessary liaison work with the providers, the on-the-ground kind of things that need to be accomplished to actually get the services provided. They also have a planning function to perform, and they need to be able to describe from their own county, local perspective, the kinds of services that they feel need to be provided in that area and the quantity and amounts of services that they are interested in managing within the context of the available budget. It's been some time, but we did try to understand what portion of the actual cost that counties incur in this regard, managing these mental health and developmental disability services at the local level. We found that this is, that the state payment to the counties represents only a portion of the cost that the county incurs in managing these services. If it weren't for the county's involvement in this, if the state had to do all of this, there would be no way we would be able to accomplish the same amount of activity for the amount of money that we send out to the counties.
Do you have data to from the counties as to how much your contribution is? And you know, can mirror that with what the state contribution is. You know,
Representative Winters, we did, as I mentioned, we did do a survey, but it has been some time ago. I think probably over 10 years ago. We don't have anything current. We could do some kind of a sampling.
I would hope that in this partnering that you do with the county, that somewhere in there that would be an automatic data collection system that would allow us to know on an ongoing basis what is the county's contribution, you know, with respect to the delivery of mental health services and, you know, how much we are providing. I think just from a budgetary and a planning tool, that would be very, very helpful in the future. Because simply just to make the statement that they do, if it wasn't for them, we would not be able to provide this array of service, I don't think is enough. And I would just think that you'd want to begin to do that, Representative Schrader.
Well, I think that's a timely comment, because central administration's increased over 50% in the last 5 years. And so we need to, I think, have a really good handle on, you know, why and where, why that huge increase and exactly what areas. And you may be correct. It's nice to hear that we're getting better value by having it done at the local level. Mm-hmm. I would hope and assume that would be the case, but it'd be nice to be able to back that up a little bit so we're comfortable to present it to other members.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, my colleague from the, who is representing the county, says that they would, we would work with them, and we'd be happy to get that information for you.
Madam Chair.
President Carlson.
Just to add to that conversation, I think I listed several questions at the outset of these testimonies about the county component of it. And my experience in sort of a cursory study of the system is that managed care has changed the system quite a bit at the county level. And so the impacts of managed care, I think, need to be considered. I talked about, remember my invisible gap question. And one of the concerns that I've had, and this is in doing a gaps analysis at the county level, is that when we have managed care and we have a contract, and so we say we're going to serve everyone that comes through the door within a certain period of time, therefore by contract, if we don't serve them, we're not fulfilling the terms of our contract. Then we, in essence, have to claim that there is no unmet need outside of who we're serving in our county mental health programs. And I think there are some nonprofits and others who are trying to go after mental health services and other agencies saying that they have homeless people and others that don't seem to get mental health services and that there is an unmet need or a gap out there. And yet the managed care system, in essence, by its very structure, denies that gap. And so I think all of that information has to be folded into a discussion about whether we're meeting the mental health needs of the community level, how well is managed care working, can we be able to identify the unmet need without making people become, in essence, out, you know, in not in compliance with the system that they've agreed to? So I think it's a critical issue.
On page 3 of this section is an organization chart that shows the different components of the administrative structure for the division.
Okay. What is the federal resources? What is that? Is it, what do those positions do?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, they do a combination of things. Several of the people who work in that unit are involved with establishing social eligibility for Social Security for children with developmental disabilities. There are other activities that are involved with management of the home and community-based care waivers that we operate in the Medicaid program that deal with expenditure analysis and reporting to the federal government on a regular basis about our activities under the waiver. they also are involved with reading the Federal Register and staying current with federal regulations, and then advising the program operations within the division about those regulations and what implications there might be for the division or for the programs.
Are these federally funded positions?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, they are.
100%.
Madam Chair, yes.
Mm-hmm. I rephrase.
They are at an administrative match rate, so it's a 50-50 match, 50% state, 50% federal.
I'd like to get the information regarding, you said they do the eligibility determination for SSI or young people. I'd like to know how many young people would be involved in that and how many peace workers or whatever you would call that for individual.
Be happy to get that.
I'm going to see if I understand this, that the federal resources position function is eligibility determination for young SSI, and then their other role, a function, is to monitor, if you will, or to keep abreast of the federal rule changes.
Madam Chair, that's correct. They also have other functions that relate to analysis of the mental health agreements under the health plan. But in all of these areas, it's a compliance function that is required by the federal Medicaid program.
Well, follow-up. Does federal Medicaid require that you have this federal resource positions?
Madam Chair, it requires that these functions be performed somewhere by the agency, by the division.
Representative Schrader.
The audit evaluations, I haven't seen too many budgets, maybe I've missed it, but that actually have a separate FTE allocation for audit function. I probably just missed it, but you get audited all the time, or is this a standard thing that I just have missed? Another budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, most of the divisions within the department have positions or this function identified, both to provide audits of internal programs and external provider types of audits. This function actually has been consolidated now within the Director's Office of the Department of Human Services, as are a number of these of the other functions. For instance, the budget function has been consolidated, but the Governor's budget presents them as part of the division. That transfer will occur in the next budget that you see. Those will all be a central consolidated service that the department will provide for all of the different components of the department.
Thank you.
Then on page 5, we have two policy packages. These both relate to the Staley Settlement Agreement in Developmental Disability Services and are part of the presentation or part of the package of the set of packages that James talked with you about 2 days ago. The Package 104 provides for an expansion in our capacity to investigate allegations of abuse, with the expansion in the number of people that will be covered in the Universal Access Package. We need to plan to provide this service for that expansion. There is also in Package 103 an expansion in the amount of financing for county government, again, local administration, in support of that expanded responsibility under the Universal Access Program.
And a question in your package, 020, and you show a reduction in your cost.
Pardon me, I missed.
On page 4C, then.
Madam Chair, that is the division's share of a reduction that occurred in the overall DHS budget, in the director's office budget, as a result of a reduction in expenditures necessary to provide support to the director's office, and it mainly relates to the budgeted amount for dealing with the Y2K issue in information systems management at the director's office level. That, of course, isn't required in the following biennium, and so that's a reduction, our share of that reduction.
So this is just your share, and so we can talk to Mr. Knott about that. Thank you.
This package is an essential package which phases in and phases out and gets the money in the right place.
Yeah, I just had a bonus question, and I'll check with Mr. McNaughton about it a little later.
I look forward to it, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. In package 103, it's funding for local administration, so there's no state FTE involved in that. Is that passed through, Sellers?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, that's correct.
Senator Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary, yesterday, the day before yesterday, you said the deadline for implementation is September 01. When do you anticipate it will be implemented for the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I believe the settlement set a timetable, which includes a September 1st or a September implementation date. We were expecting to implement the program July 1st. It may be in September or it may be sometime in between. We're still working to secure the necessary federal waivers to make that happen. The waiver application has been prepared. We've been working with the Healthcare Financing Administration. I think if we could ask Mr. Taves to respond more specifically to where we are today and what our expectation is. We do expect that in working with LFO and DAS around reorganizing this budget to get a final budget, that there will be some adjustments in this daily component.
Madam Chair, could we have follow-up response from Mr. Taves?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, there's a whole different set of dates for different activities in the Staley agreement. So it's not a matter of it's one day it's implemented and then the next it's not. The way it's laid out is at the beginning of the biennium in July, we allocate essentially all the case management positions, the local administration, and the other parts to put the programs and the organizations together. So because we're obviously ramping up and will eventually enroll thousands of new people. In the agreement itself, all of the rules in which how the plan is done for individuals and families, how the rates are set, and all of that is scheduled in the settlement agreement as a deadline by September. So we're working through a whole series of different timelines and are just now beginning to look at the rollout schedule, how we'll actually roll the program out in each area of the state and what the time sequence for that will be. So there's not a single date at which point we're implemented or not implemented. It's actually over the four-year time span of the agreement.
A follow-up.
Well, you do have to send RFP out to contract with your brokerage providers. So how long do you think that process would take?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we expect to have contracts in place by near the beginning of July. What's difficult to predict right now because we haven't finished the rollout schedule is whether or not we're going to mount the phase-in simultaneously all over the state or do it geographically and in a sense pick regions of the state where we will accelerate the rollout and then cover other parts of the state later. And the reason for that is it's a very complex blending of existing programs and existing resources with new dollars and people already served but at a lower level than anticipated in this Staley agreement with completely new people that will be served. So it's a blending of all that together, and as we've gone through a very detailed implementation planning discussion with all the advocates and the providers and the counties and everyone else, the emerging thought is that what we ought to do is accelerate enrollments in a geographic rollout so that we can go to one area of the state, blend all those complex fund sources into the entitlement pool, if you want to call it that, and then move to the next area.
Another question, Madam Chair. Could we have a schedule of your, you call them rolling in of the different regions? Can we have a schedule of your timeline in implementing state aid case in different regions of the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that is not completed as of yet. And under the requirements of this Staley agreement, we have to negotiate that with a large group of stakeholders, which we're currently in the process of doing. So we don't have that implementation schedule in place at this point.
On the one hand, Madam Chair, with your permission.
Sure.
On the one hand, you want to implement it by July 1. On the other hand, you don't have a schedule. I'm sure you must have a schedule in order to implement it as the state aid case calls for.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we're not implementing the Staley agreement by July 1st. Beginning in July 1st, we initiate a whole series of activities and start funding components of the plan that then continues to roll out, and a rollout is a poor term, that continues to phase in with new people enrolled as well as people in existing service brought into the terms of the Staley agreement. That progression continues over 4 years. So July 1 is not an implementation date. July 1 is just the initiation of certain activities that continue throughout the entire 4 to 6 year period of the entire agreement.
I'm interested in a time schedule that you are going to implement it. So just so we know which region will be phasing, which is the next region, I'm interested in a timeline.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we'll get that to you just as soon as we have it put together.
Just so we understand, because what you're doing also has to correlate with budgetary decisions, that we're doing here, and I think that's what Senator Yee is trying to get at. And so in looking at implementing the agreement, how much of what you're doing beginning July 1 is budgetary and those budgetary implications, how much that you're doing in September or whatever your plan is, and she's trying to get at these budgetary implications. When are you hiring your case managers, for example, those kinds of planning tools that you would be using, and it would be helpful if we had that kind of rollout information, if you will. Mm-hmm. Not just necessarily the brokers, but what's your plan as a division to implement the agreement? And we know that it's not finite and that it evolves, but we do need some kind of framework. It does not. Is that where you're going?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for making it very clear that it has very clear budgetary implications.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, I will move along to capital improvement, which is the next behind the
Representative
I guess I'm struggling here a little bit with the division administration, and that we also have administration for DD, and it has a separate administrative department, and then mental health has a separate department. And I guess I'm wondering, do they have a budget section within their department? Do they have a contract section within theirs? And do they have a general services? And what do those administrative people do?
And Chair Representative Schrader, the administrative component in each of the two program offices consists only of a general management, for instance, both James and Madeline's position, and then folks who work in managing the specific programs. All of the support services are provided either in the Office of Finance or out of the Director's Office of the Department of Human Services. So there's no duplication of those other administrative functions within the administrative component of each of the program offices.
I'm sure.
Well,
they're, like in the Mental Health Administration, there's 52 people there. And looking at least the LFO analysis, it says the office certifies or licenses 33 county mental health programs, 107 contracting agency, 11 mental health organizations. Then I see in the division administration budget, there's three more positions, not a lot, but three more, for doing contract work and stuff, too. I guess I'm confused.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, in the program offices, the function that relates to contracting, this is an example, is that the people who are responsible for implementing a particular program, say foster care, know the requirements of essentially what the statement of work would be in the contract that we would craft, and that's what they do. They just describe what the program standards are. And then that involvement with the contract ends. They hand that off to a contract specialist who actually writes the legal contract and puts all of the other required components around that contract. So it's a cooperative arrangement whereby the folks who know the program describe what they want to buy, and the people who put the contracts together develop the legal framework and the contract boilerplates and the other things that are required for the contracting process. We have provided to you, as a result of the request for some follow-up information, we have a detailed list of all of our administrative positions in the division and what they're responsible for, and we have that available today, and we'll provide that to you so you can see in greater detail what's there.
Since you mentioned contracts is it standard procedure that all of your contracts go through, and even though they're boilerplate or have a template, that they still go through the AG's office for review?
Well, we did in the beginning.
Madam Chair, when we develop in the contracting process at the inception of the contracts, yes, they go to the Attorney General's office and for their review. But once that review has been accomplished, then if there are amendments to the contract that don't substantially change the nature of the contract, for an example, would be an increase or decrease in funding level, then those don't go to the Attorney General's office for review.
I guess the one that I'm thinking of is, because it came to my desk, is the Jasper Mountain issue, where, as I understand it, the technician within the division was actually the expert who helped put everything together, and yet, it's taken a very long time of getting that contract through the process simply because of the amount of reviews and the loops that go through. Getting some of those resolved, it seems to me, and I've had a conversation with the AG's office of where if there's a template, why would they need to continue to have, that kind of review and oversight?
Madam Chair, and that was a very unique situation. It's not at all representative of the way that the regular bulk of the business is accomplished. But, yes, there has been Attorney General review of the Scar Jasper Mountain issue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Madam Chair, I raise my same question. I often do. I wonder if the division, this particular division, is properly named. And the reason I look at is I look at many of these things. They're not administration. I look at the general services and support. I look at the federal resources, for example, where they're looking at eligibility. I mean, those are actual functional line kinds of things. And again, it's my concern throughout state government, we inconsistently use the term administration, which administration has, in some way, I really ought to take a good look at defining administration and support services and so forth, because I think there's a feeling that it's top-heavy or something like that. And I don't see that. I see those as functional staff, not that an administrator isn't, but it isn't. These are not supervisory kinds of positions, doesn't seem to me, in most cases. I think it's just something throughout state government that really bothers me, because people then will say, well, they have all of those administrators in state government. Well, they are not administrators, even though they are in the division of administration. And I just bring that out. I think it needs to, we need to take a good look at it throughout state government and redefine those terms.
We should have a conversation with staff.
Madam Chair, may I? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I'd like to make a comment about the Department of Human Services and its reorganization. It may, I don't know if it'll help in this context or not, but the divisions of the department originated in their own legislative framework. And over the years, we've evolved to the point where the department is now ready to say to us, in effect, we will perform these contract functions for you. We will perform these budget functions for you. But the budgeting on that hasn't been done. And as Margie pointed out a few minutes ago, the next time we come here, I expect that most of the positions, let me say, I don't think institutional revenue is likely to migrate to the department. And it's not clear what's going to happen with federal resources, but most of what we do in the Office of Finance is going to be done by the Department of Human Services under the Chief Administrative Officer. But that organizational work, although those responsibilities have transferred, they're still reflected in our budget. As a matter of principle, we need to have people who understand contracts, understand budgets, understand how this system operates as close to the program as possible. So in the new Department of Human Services, we're the ones who are going to go away. The Office of Developmental Disability Services and the Office of Mental Health will play key policy roles, and they will need to be able to respond to the department when the department says, how much is it going to cost if we amend the contract with Jasper Mountain? Just as an example, because it's one that's on your mind, I know. And we need to be able to answer that question, or I should say James and Madeline need to be able to answer that question. We're in transition now, and I think those administrative functions are going to be consolidated. They are going to be more efficient, although I think for the money, with almost a quarter of the department's budget, we've delivered a pretty good product for them, and we know where those dollars are and how they're flowing. So at this point, at least, the way it's structured is subject to a lot of review. It's happening at the department level. Even as we're meeting here, that analysis is taking place, and I think the department will have more to say about this in the, as Mr. Naughton pointed out, in the final organization of this budget.
Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up with what Senator Duncan and Representative Schrader brought up, because in looking through this LFO analysis, this budget seems to be organized differently than the other budgets that we've seen, and we have this Mental Health Administration, Developmental Disability Administration, Central Administration, Local Administration. So it feels like there's a lot of administration in the budget just by the terms that are used and the way that the budget structures are put together. So, and I understand that reorganization may change that, but at the same time, we need to make decisions here about what rolls forward. So, and I don't know how much work this is going to be, and I know Senator Duncan always makes the comment about how much are we asking people to do. But if it's possible, I would be really interested by category of function to know across those administrative budget structures. So, for example, if you have certification as one, you know, contracts as another, fiscal as another, supervision as another, then actually on-the-ground services, the numbers of FTE in those different budget structures that you have here for mental health, DD, and central, so that we could get a sense of where the crossovers of functions are through those. And then I would really be interested, too, in the content of the local administration, because as I read the description of the program description, as Senator Duncan mentioned, it doesn't feel like administration to me. I think those monies actually go into direct services. Am I wrong on that, or is this $22 million of administrative money? So I think it would be really helpful for us in making budget decisions about whether this is a lean and mean budget or whether we need to, you know, actually look at some savings if we have that information.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, we'd be happy to look at that. The list of positions in our central administration category is that we will provide to you goes partway toward getting you that.
Okay.
The other thing that might be helpful is in our agreement with counties, when we contract out the local administration money, we have a statement of what the requirements are that they do with that money, and that might a copy of that might be helpful as well.
I think two things for us that would be very helpful to get at this administrative cost issue. And that's the separation of, you know, we know the contract money that flows through, and we know that probably a percentage of them is their administration. So that's one, you know, separate category. I think what this body is trying to say is that if we look at your budget, it all kind of lumps into your administrative pot, and we know that that could not be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that separation would be helpful for this body, what's happening at the state level for administration and what you're passing through to your local communities. And, you know, if they're taking a bite administratively, and if you can identify that, then that's helpful. We know that there's two different functions that you actually are doing, and yet your budget implies that somehow all this is, you've got a huge administrative budget, if you can follow where this body's going. But I want to make a comment because Barry mentioned the reorg, and I am in conversation with the department to talk about the reorg and what's occurring there. And I will be giving some information as soon as they shortly to this body because we are having some of those discussions as to how some of this will work and to make sure that we are keeping that the system doesn't get a disconnect.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to the capital improvement section, which is the next tab. We have in the budget for capital improvement a little over $1.1 million. Of state general fund to finance the necessary capital improvements to our facilities, both at the state hospital and at our two facilities in Pendleton, Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center and Training Centers. We use this money to we triage this money and use it to address the most critical issues that need to be addressed in order to maintain our accreditation and certification and licensure as hospital and training center facilities. There's a short description of some of the physical characteristics of our facilities. We have 1.4 million square feet to manage and about 170 acres and approximately 92 buildings now. And as you know, they range in age from the oldest at Oregon State Hospital, which was built in 1883, to one small building at Eastern Oregon in Pendleton that was built as latest in 1985. But by and large, we have old aging facilities, and the challenges which accompany those are tremendous. We have prioritized a number of projects that we at this point anticipate using this budget for. It would include at Oregon State Hospital an upgrade of fire life safety issues, a fire alarm system, and smoke evacuation system. We need to upgrade the key card lock system at the state hospital. The state fire marshal raised concerns about the many different types of locks that are in place in the hospital and that it adds complications to evacuation of the buildings in a fire situation. We also need to upgrade the panic alarm system at the state hospital. There are numerous security improvements that need to be made as well. And at the state hospital, we have also allocated a smaller portion of this to deal with some issues at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, which would include we need a new hot water heat exchanger, for instance, at the psychiatric center. There needs to be a lighting upgrade at the training center. We have we manage from lists in detail of projects that need to be performed. The state hospital alone has $13.1 million in deferred maintenance identified, not all of which is as critical as these items are that I just mentioned. But my point is that we staff in our facilities manage closely to the resources that are available. The list that we have now would anticipate what the highest priorities are that we will be able to accomplish with this money, but as things sometimes things develop and we need to move those projects around. But that's what we will what we would anticipate using the $1.1 million in capital improvement for.
Bates. Thank you, Chair Schrader. A couple questions. When was your last JCO inspection?
The Joint Commission inspected the state hospital last December, and that was there every 3 years, I believe. And that was we were accredited for another 3 years with minor corrective actions required. Whenever the Joint Commission comes, they present us with a list of things that need to be either improved or fixed in terms of the physical plant.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Go ahead. I'd be interested in seeing what the corrections they wanted were and how you scored in those, if you got any negatives. And a follow-up, continuing with that, is I'd like to see what they thought of the programs as well as just the buildings. I'm sure they did both. Mm-hmm. The fact that you received a three-year accreditation for the future as an indication did fairly well. Often they'll give 1 or 2 years if they're concerned about a facility. So I'd like to see what the results of those were. Thank you.
We'd be happy to get that.
Senator Shields.
As you're talking about accreditation, certification, licensure, and JCO, and you've got $13.1 million in deferred maintenance just at the one building, is there going to come a time when some inspection like this is going to trigger, you know, just a waiting time bomb, and all of a sudden we're going to have $10 million of capital improvements that we have to make or something like that? I look at these buildings, and I just keep saying, how long can you defer? How long can you keep waiting? I realize it's not because of you. It's because we don't give you the money to do it with. So, it's our responsibility. But at some point, will something outside of the state, an inspection like this, a certification, a licensure, will it jump out and bite us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, you're asking me to prognosticate on something that I think obviously yes. I mean there's always the chance that there would be a serious situation that could arise. I am in responding to Representative Bates' comments about the accreditation survey by the Joint Commission. I think we do remarkably well with the facilities and the maintenance staff at the facilities and the folks who have to deal with these cranky old buildings on a daily basis do an amazing job. And the routine kinds of maintenance, we are budgeted for that. We paint the walls, we keep the floors clean, we do those sorts of routine maintenance activities to make sure that we have a safe and hygienic place. We're proud of that. Catastrophic occurrences, I think that we're always at risk of something, but I do think that we manage quite well and prioritize with the resources that we do have.
Mr. Chair, the best predictor of this is probably where we've been. We got an engineering report 10 years ago that in the tall building that you visited yesterday, the 50 building, we visited a ward on the top floor and a ward in the middle. Mm-hmm. That the exterior walls were at risk of failure because the bolts were corroding a building that was 50 years old. So we brought that problem forward as a as an issue. We're always watching. I don't think you're going to read in the paper tomorrow that a building fell down, but it's that we treat our physical plant on an emergency basis for issues like that rather than a regular plan for replacement or for upgrading. And that's not just your fault. We're always trading service priorities for capital priorities. That's just the way it is in this division. And there is another way to look at it. We discussed that last week, to change the way the budget's organized so that there is a sinking fund and we're constantly making investments in a fund that allows us to bring the physical plant up. But I think that's been looked at. And given the financial constraints the state's under, we just have not been able to make that adjustment. But that option is there, and we'll continue to talk about it. And in the meantime, Stan Mazart and Maxine Stone, our superintendents, are watching their physical plant. We have people who know what's happening in them, and I don't think that there's a threat that you're going to open your Oregonian tomorrow and find a catastrophic failure. But we know where the problems are, and we'll bring them forward in priority order as we do every biennium.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at your real budget document as opposed to the presentation document, and I see in here that you talk about the $1.2 million in current service level for water distribution systems, sidewalks, sanitarium, storm sewers, and ward remodeling. And then I looked back and saw that you had an option package that's not recommended, where some of the things that it lists are things that you mentioned that you're actually now planning, you sort of picked out to do within the $1.2 million. So I guess my question is two-pronged. The first is, were there things that you would have done within the $1.2 that you're not doing now because you've taken some of these things in the package and offset? And then the second question is the earlier one I asked about your ADA short and long range plan. Are there items within the current service budget that you're doing that will address some of those ADA issues at the state hospital?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the governor's budget document, the big book, there were a list. There have been some revisions to that list, and that was kind of going back to the comments that I made earlier that we do have to, sometimes projects, we will trade one project for another if we feel that we have something more critical to deal with as a result of whatever emerging problem we are aware of. And as to the ADA issue, we have, the staff at the hospital have identified all of the ADA projects that are required, and have listed those in priority order, and we would be happy to make that detail available to you.
Oh, Mr. Chair. My question is, are any of those projects going to be accomplished within the 1.2 million in this biennium? That's my main question.
There are, yes, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, there are selected ADA compliance issues embedded in the projects that I generally described.
All right, thank you.
How many of the buildings are currently in use?
Mr. Chair, all of the buildings that are listed, with the exception of the central part of the J building at the State Hospital campus, are in use.
All 70 buildings are listed here?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Not all are for patient care or for resident care. Some are for the physical plant maintenance shop and that sort of thing, but they are in use.
All fully utilized? In other words, the space is fully occupied?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Stan to respond to that. As far as I know, yes, they are. There are, with the exception of parts of the J building, which are not habitable, they are in use.
I'm kind of reminded, sounds like a very tough situation, and I'm kind of reminded of the Parks Division that also found itself facing a huge backlog of what they call deferred maintenance. I don't call this maintenance. I call this capital needs, capital expenditures. And, in business, you usually don't pay for capital expenditures out of your cash account. Usually you take a loan out, you take care of the stuff, and you pay it back over time. And it does cost you a little bit, but if you do it up front, hopefully it's not deteriorating at an accelerated rate. So maybe while it costs you a little bit more, it doesn't cost you quite as much as it would when the building does fall down or the bolts fall out of the walls. Do you have a capital improvement plan for like 10 or 15 years? And then secondly, have you considered trying to use like the 1.2 as debt service to take out either a GO bond or maybe lottery back bond to get at your capital needs and pay that down then over time?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, yes, we've considered all of the possible opportunities for financing this differently. One of the issues we have with this type of budget is that, for instance, a capital financing bond that would be like a COP through the state wouldn't typically be used in this manner. For us to have, as Barry mentioned, a sinking fund would require an additional resource that we don't currently have budgeted, because we don't pay ourselves rent. We don't have a line item budget for our what would essentially be rent to another state agency that they would pay to occupy space, since we own all of these buildings and we don't have a deferred maintenance or sinking fund that's been budgeted.
Well, if I may, what I'm getting at is with the Parks Department last session, we use lottery back bonds, and they don't get rent particularly that's going to pay them back either. But what I would assume is what we could try and do is potentially through budget note or something to make sure you get at least the 1.2 each biennium, and you know, or whatever, to try and make sure you can pay that back. You know, the state general fund would be, quite frankly, better used over a longer period of time, I think, by getting you to take care of some of the bigger needs up front. As long as we had a plan and knew these things were being addressed, it'd be a check and balance. That money would continue to flow, providing continue to deliver on the maintenance or capital repairs that you're doing. So I don't know why that couldn't be done here. An option.
Madam Chair, we would be responsive to working with you to find a way to restructure the budget the governor's brought forward to accomplish a longer-term vision. But given that there are immediate needs and that we can't capture from our existing revenue stream the resources to amortize that kind of an obligation, we don't see a solution to that. It's not that it hasn't been considered, but we'll look again at how we might accomplish that kind of a.
Perhaps this is something, Administrator, that you Barry and George can sit down and see what kinds of options may be available. Senator Yu, did you have some questions?
Well, I have some questions, but it has to do with the cost to clients in the state-operated homes. Compared to the community-operated homes. And that question was raised during public hearing. Your cost per client, you asked for increase of 15 clients in the state-operated homes, and it figures out to be about $467,000 per year. So my question is, according to Providence Hospital, they were telling us they charge about $281 a day, which comes to about $102,000 per client. So instead of increasing capacity to increase 15 clients at a cost of $467,000 per year per person, is there any consideration to contract out, provide the same service, and save the state a significant amount of money?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, the approximately $14 million increase in the overall state-operated program from this current biennium to next biennium has virtually very little to do with 15 people. It is the biennialized and roll-up costs from phasing in state-operated programs for people that left Fairview preceding the closure. And since most of those programs phased in towards the end of the Fairview closure period, obviously they were only funded for a portion of the biennium, and now we have to spread that full cost over the 24 months going into the next biennium. So that's where the increase is. The 15 people has virtually nothing to do with that biennialized roll-up cost. And if you would like, we could give you a precise breakdown of that $14 million increase and how the number of client months that were funded in 99-01 then roll out over 24 months in 2001-2003.
Yes, I would appreciate an explanation. Why is it $467,000 per year per client? And also, why is the staff increase 114 people? Or increase of 15 clients. This is a ratio of 7.6 to 1. Can you explain what is the reason?
Again, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, it's not $460,000 per person. It's not 15 people divided into that $14 million. That $14 million is the full biennial 24-month cost for operating the entire state-operated program as it phased in, as the people left preceding the closure of Fairview, because it was only funded for part of the biennium because it was phased in. So it's not the 15 people. It's the biennialized and roll-up costs for the full state-operated program. And we can show the schedule for you that will pretty easily explain that.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. My second question is, why is the FTE increase from 01 to 03, 114 people to serve 15 more clients, a ratio of 7.6 to 1. Can you explain why?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, it's the same issue as with the dollars, because when staff are not fully funded throughout the biennium, they're not shown as full FTE. And so now again, since that program is fully biennialized and rolled up, because it was phased in, we have to schedule the full amount of FTE. And I think, again, if we can just show you a schedule of how that actually works, it would probably be much easier to explain.
If you can get a schedule on that, that would be appreciated. Senator Shield.
Madam Chair, we saw this coming in the 97 subcommittee, and in 99 we knew that this was going to happen, that you'd have just a little bit of the biennium, and that this time there would be the full biennial cost, both for program and personnel. It's somewhat complicated, but it does make sense.
Madam Chair, if I could add, we deliberately scheduled most of the phase-in of the state-operated programs towards the end of the Fairview closure, and the reason for that, it was a clear strategy to try to protect the health and safety of the people left at Fairview so that we could do early recruitment and hiring of state staff still at Fairview, in a sense, assure them jobs after the closure in state-operated programs, so we had a core group of staff that were still left to the point that we closed the lights out. And we took our cues from a lot of other states that got into very dangerous situations where people died and were badly injured towards the end of the closure because nobody was there, all the staff had left, the clinicians had departed, and so we tried to do this in a very different way. And so those state-operated programs phased in towards the end of the closure period, so they were only funded for a portion of last biennium, and now we have to fund them for the full upcoming biennium.
Yes, but the schedule would be helpful to put it into context.
We'll do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gates.
Yes. Madam Chair, I noticed in the budget narrative there's a Joint Commission Statement of Conditions plan that was not recommended by the governor's budget. Can you tell me now what that is? I appreciate it. If you can tell me later, I appreciate it too. I don't want you in trouble in 2 or 3 years complying with what appears to be recommendations from JCO.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we will. We had proposed a budget package that would provide us assistance in doing a longer-term plan for capital needs, but compliance with the Joint Commission isn't in jeopardy because of our inability to do that. We will continue to respond to the issues raised by the Joint Commission.
We'll include that in our You've asked for a copy of that report, and we'll detail all of that for you.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm so concerned about this is if you lose your JCO accreditation, you lose your Medicare and Medicaid funds. And I've been through some real tough hospital situations with JCAH, and they can do it. They can do it. And a different group comes through every 3 years, and they'll look at the previous recommendations, maybe look at them, maybe not look at them. But I don't want to be in a position here in a couple of years where we've got a problem on our hands requiring sudden insertions of large capital expenditures to meet their requirements. So I think it's very important. If they've listed things they think you should be doing, I think we need to take it very seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Bates, for raising that accreditation issue.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, on page 4D1, which displays our capital budget, if this was 6 years ago, we would have had about 192 buildings under our control. That reflects the closure of both Gamish State Hospital and Fairview Training Center. We recognize that there have been concerns expressed by the Chair, as well as others, about the costs of our maintenance at Fairview, and also that the co-chairs and the governor both have looked at this issue and reduced what they anticipate that budget will be. We expect to bring those costs down beginning this month and toward the end of the biennium to within the budgeted projected amounts. We've asked, at your invitation, David White from DAS to be here today to talk about what is happening in our relationship to liquidate those properties and dedicate the revenues as the legislature has directed to trust funds for housing development in both DD and mental health. And this might be, since we're approaching the end of our time with you, a good time to bring him forward and have a discussion of those issues.
Thank you. It is a good time. Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, is this a good time for me to ask a question under the appendix regarding the health division, mental health division, response to task force questions?
After we hear from Mr. White, because I really do want to know the disposition of the Fairview property.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll let you answer the health question.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, as Mr. White's coming up, I just wanted to call your attention. There was earlier questions about the Capital Projects Advisory Board, and I handed out to you, you should have at your place, a report that board, or the recommendations that board had for this agency. There is not a report per se that goes to legislators for all agencies, but the information is available if we ask for it. Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Dave White, the administrator of the Facilities Division, Department of Administrative Services. I will also mention that I'll offer my services with George McNaught and Barry to look at if there's any way we can help with their facility planning in the future. We know we get to practice a family practice clinic in facilities, and they're the emergency room, so we do understand the situation. It's also fair to just a couple of introductory remarks. I won't go through all of this that I've handed out to you, and I apologize that we didn't three-hole punch. I wasn't thinking ways and means. The in 140 years, the state has sold one campus. That was the Callahan Center. And now it's selling two campuses, and they're both with Mental Health, who's never sold a campus, never closed a campus until now. And so is there some stress? There sure is. We have three other major properties, two for sale now, and so we go from one property in 140 years to four or five all at one time. It's been an interesting ride so far. We have learned one thing, and that is as everyone gives us advice, and we do get a lot, and we try to listen to it all, we ask just one question, and that is, have you ever done this? Because most of the advice comes from somebody who knows somebody who did it, or they read something, and we're doing that too. We're like registered nurses getting ready for surgery. To do the surgery, and so we're trying to read the book and do it right. The Fairview Training Center, I should just say where Gamish is first. Gamish is on the market. We have advertised out across the nation for people to respond that would develop the Gamish site. We're able to move Gamish faster because of a couple of reasons. Wilsonville is aggressively pursuing a large plan to which Gamish is a central element, and so they carry whips, they offer help, they do anything they can to help that thing move. The other thing is that Damish, because of its location, has inspired a lot of interest. We've had calls on it from the day that people first heard it might be available. Fairview has not. Until recently, it has not. We have been working through a process. The process is under constant change, and as I speak to you today, it's just had some fairly significant changes. The plan was a very orderly process by which we would take the property through zoning and through an understanding with the city, and then on out, Fairview, on out to the market for a developer. That would mean that somewhat like the Fairview industrial property, we might still be receiving money from this property 10 years from now or 15 years from now, because it would be developed over time, the state holding it in the meantime. All the advice was that if you sell it quickly, you'll lose money. Of course, it's somewhere between selling it quickly and holding it until it's fully developed and it's worth $40 or $50 million. That means developing it ourselves. We're not going to do that. That's not the state's business. And so we've been on this mode. We were going to be putting Fairview on the market in the fall, just as we have Damish right now. It doesn't make a lot of sense in our minds to have Damish and Fairview both out there competing with each other in the national market at one time. However, since that time, the city has just this week given us a kind of a new signal. Instead of saying that it would take a couple years for them to do the zoning, they're now suggesting they might do it in 4 months, which would be helpful.
Dave, was that prompted by the offer? There's an offer on the table.
We're not sure what might have prompted it, but that could be a factor. We've moved from where we have, I would say, a sort of an offer right now. It's not an offer that we can yet say meets any of the basic qualifications, but it's gotten closer. I think we've gone through four versions of it. At the same time that we're looking at this offer, which seems to be developing toward what we must have. What we must have is an offer to buy the campus as is for its appraised value, not an offer to make it conditional. That kind of conditional offers could come in the fall when we have the whole world competing to come up with their ideas on how to do it. But if it's an offer now to buy now, it must be a competitive offer to buy as is. And we don't quite have that yet, but we think it is coming. Also, in the middle of this, word was out that we might have an offer, and we had another party contact us through their broker and say, we're interested, too. So you put this together, and you have the city saying they'll move faster. You have two offers, possibly, where there has been no interest at all. And we are seriously considering putting it on the market immediately. We know that whatever we do, no matter which way it goes, and if you directed us in a direction, you'd get to share that. People will ultimately say, I could have got a better deal if you'd done this or done that. That just goes with the territory. We have that from our brother-in-law when we sell our house. It's just going to be there. What we want to do is do the best thing that we can. Now, if you look at the decision point sheet that I gave you, it probably lays this out best. We're at a juncture where right now we have to make a decision. Either we offer the property for sale as is, competitive bids, give us your bid, buy the property, that's it. Or we continue on the planned development approach, which we have followed so far and which we are underway up at Damish. If we do the offer as is, we're either going to get a buyer or we're not. If we get a buyer, it's over, done. If we do not, then we're going to go back to the fall option and be offering it out for planned development. In that planned development option, there are a couple of possibilities. One is that we will find a developer, and that developer will, then it will depend a lot on terms. One developer may say, I want to take the existing buildings and develop now, and I want you to hold the other property in bank, even though I'm buying it essentially, and I'll pay you over time. That's a very valuable process that the state can offer, because we have no carrying costs on the bare land. We can just keep it for 50 years if that was appropriate. That's something that only a government can offer and ought to add value. That's why we're tilted in favor of that approach. If, on the other hand, the developer says, well, I only want to take some of the buildings now, I'll pay more, but I want to develop some of the land now, then we have the buildings to deal with. And the question on the buildings is, they cannot be operated as they have been as a campus. That's close to $1 million a biennium just to heat the things, just to keep the sprinklers overhead from freezing. Not a workable process at all. On the other hand, we can't lease them now and put people into them because we could sell them in 3 months. If you lease them, you tie it all up and complicate that factor. So So when we go through this fall issue, we either get a developer and go down that route, or we don't get a developer. If we don't, our current plan would be to install heating plants on some of the buildings that are modern, that would be far, far lower cost, and start leasing those buildings out, because we can see that it's going to be a more time-consuming process. If we do that, then the property should be able to bring up itself to about a sustaining level and hopefully give us time to move on. There are other options. Maybe you don't do that. Maybe instead, at that point, you list with a broker and say, I'm going to cut my losses by taking some loss here, pay a broker, get it out that way, go for a lower price. You might also just reoffer again and say, okay, we didn't get it that time. Maybe we didn't punctuate our story right. We'll do it again and try to do it better. You might sell it in pieces. The Salem-Keizer School District is interested in buying a school there. That's part of a plan development that there would be the school there. Probably any buyer would be interested in having a school there if they're talking about residential development.
Dave, as I understand it, the Salem-Keizer, because they came to me, that they're interested. And then there's another group who is also interested, but they're primarily interested in the state pretty much giving them the land,
yeah.
and for them to do some esoteric kinds of things on the land. Am I not correct?
Madam Chair, I think that may be true in some cases. At this point, we haven't sat with Salem-Keizer School, so we're not sure that that's the case there. We believe they would ultimately expect to buy. Most local governments at one point or another suggest the state might give them the property. And we have just one answer for that, and that is only if the legislature directs us to do so. Gifts come from the legislature. They don't, even though technically under the law we can give it away, it clearly is not what would be intended. But selling in pieces could be an issue. I mean, clearly what we didn't want to do initially was sell it in pieces, because the top property up along Battle Creek or... not Battle Creek there, the street has a different name, but up along the top of the property would sell right away for prime large building lots, and you'd be left ultimately with the worst pieces. And as any builder can tell you, if you end up with the last two lots not selling, you may have lost your profit. So that is a problem, holding it and reoffering it. The options are here. There's a lot of uncertainty. We are thinking that we're hearing from the legislature, and now we're hearing from potential buyers, that we ought to offer it out now as is. And unlike Damish is an isolated building largely, and we have an agreement with the local fire authorities that they won't fight a fire there. They will instead just protect the neighborhood, which is some distance away from it. So we are now just paying for security only. That's it. No maintenance, no safety other than security. Can't do that with Fairview. It's in the middle of the city. It's got a lot of buildings, extreme danger to others if they're not adequately protected.
Representative Schrader.
I guess I would like to sit down with you and have a meeting and discuss this. I mean, it's obvious the government's uncomfortable doing business transactions. That's what I'm hearing here. And while it's exciting and it's interesting, I'm very concerned that we're not pursuing this in a business-like manner. I mean, they're basically, we should have someone who is comfortable dealing with this sort of thing, perhaps doing it. This is straightforward. I mean, you decide on one or two options. I think you either sell it as is. That's very simple. You don't parcel this thing out. I don't think the state's in the business of doing that type of work. It would be inappropriate, as well as probably not done well, because that's not what we do well around here.
I agree.
The other thing is make a decision. I'd like to see the legislature involved a little bit in a discussion, at the very least, about whether or not it is advisable for us to provide the infrastructure. Additional infrastructure on some of these sites, and do we get more for our money, and if so, over what time frame if we go that route? Rather than accidentally follow a route of attack, I think we should make some very strong, hard decisions based on the business climate we have now, what we expect to have in the next year or two, and come to a decision. I think this would be, and I would like to see it, quite frankly, in some sort of budget note, so we can, the next legislature, after I'm dead and gone, you kind of track when and if
these...
that would be true. For Vernal Hill.
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, I don't think I gave the right impression if I felt that we're just kind of dinkering around on this. We clearly have two plans. It is clear that we had one all the way that was consistently recommended by real estate economists, real estate brokers, the consultants we hired that have been through it. And we were following it. Now we have, and I think any business does this, I have a plan, but I just got a better offer. And they don't stick with a plan and say, forget the offer.
But I don't think we should be in the business of maintaining these buildings off and on for however long we need to be. And I'd be curious how much money we've already spent trying to figure out how to salvage this property and these buildings.
Representative Schrader, I raised this at the e-board when we first got the figure of how much it would cost to mothball, and I think I almost went into apoplexy sitting up there.
We all get.
And the instruction has been since then that we move forward in getting this land liquidated, that it would cost us more to continue down the path of mothballing while we do the infrastructure and do all these other things, and we would not get the return on our investment in the long haul. I think we looked at what if we sold it now. I think it's something like $7 million or so. If we delayed and did all the other stuff, plus the infrastructure, plus the mothballing, I think we would end up that we would be kind of net zero. So the push is there, and I think the agency has heard the push from legislators that we want them to go forward, do good, and to get the property.
Well, but Madam Chair. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. Representative Carl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make the point. I know that you know this, but I don't know if the other members of the committee know this, but Fairview is in my district, and in fact, my neighborhood is right across the street from Fairview property. So while I certainly want to make sure that we move forward, I don't want to move forward at the cost of having a wise development of that area. So, and I've asked the agency to keep me posted on developments as it moves forward.
Senator Duncan.
And Madam Chair, I might just comment again. I think, again, the legislature, we're part of the problem. Let's just look at the damage deal. You could have been 2 years ahead if we hadn't played around with prisons and sort of things like that. So,
the chronological group, chronological advantage group down there on that end.
We have long memories.
Long memories. Remember the debate.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to put in the dog in this fight, but I'll just throw it out at you, and you've probably already considered this, and it's probably one you've heard before. You know, in my area down there, we have a large number of corporations that have large land holdings. They've chosen not to sell those holdings because they feel that in the long term, not short term, long term, they can lease the land to outfits like Costco and Walmart and to light industry. And they've held on to those lands, leased the land out, and done well. Our school district is doing the same thing. We elected to not sell the land. The reason being that in our area of the woods, good Lord, isn't making any more land for us. And then when we go out to buy land at a later time, it costs us a fortune. And I'm sure you've probably already considered that, but if you haven't, I'd ask you to.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we have. And if I might point out just from the comments here, all of which are intelligent, all of which are on course, I rest my case.
Right.
Senator Yee.
Just thank you and smile.
I should mention, though, Madam Chair, that we have about 3 meetings next week. I expect out of those that we will be offering this for sale within well before the legislature could put a budget note in place for us. We think that that's going to be obvious.
I believe I have a meeting with you guys.
We also believe the city and the normal process will also protect the neighborhood. They will just have to deal with the developer in that case.
Senator Yee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with the division's response to the interim committee's question. And on page 2 of the appendix, top paragraph, you say number of people who are served on second line, 87,630 in fiscal year 1999-00. I would like a breakdown of this number into CPMS number for 99-00 and for Encounter data, number of people served January through June 1999-2000. And I have asked previously, how do you unduplicate the count when you combine the 3 data systems, one of which you don't count services less contacts less than 9. So these are my questions on your response. And with your permission, Madam Chair, I have another question on 4B14. And you indicated under support services For 0103, it's going to be expanded to 15 and 5 people. So I would like to know how many are getting any kind of services now, and how are they being funded?
Madam Chair, Senator, which page are you?
0103 at a cost of $30.1 million. So are they receiving any kind of services now, and how is it being funded?
I know.
Yeah. So you can give it to us in written response.
Thank you.
Would that be helpful?
Permission.
Well, it would be feasible, yes. We'll do that. I wanted to point out, Madam Chair and Senator Yee, that we will be delivering to staff responses to the questions you've asked, and there is included in that a rather detailed description with an example, as you requested, of how the databases work together and how we unduplicate them through analysis. And I read it myself with, and I think I learned quite a bit from it, and I think it's a pretty good description in terms that I could understand about how those databases work.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a number of issues which you've raised in the 2 weeks we've been here, which I think are addressed there, and we will respond to these additional questions from Senator Yee in a separate response, if that's acceptable
that's
to you.
Acceptable.
Yeah, I would appreciate it.
Thank you very much, have a good weekend. I think there's some in this building who will not be here tomorrow. Some of us who live in Salem always are in this building. The house is having a back in the district.
District Day.
But I think that I know that Representative Schrader and I tend to spend a lot more time in this building than most. But with that, if there's no further questions, we are adjourned.